Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Young Turks decided to eliminate an entire ethnic group that lived alongside them within the Ottoman Empire. The Armenian Genocide, in which some 1.5 million Armenians were systematically killed, is considered the first of the 20th century by many scholars. Then we'll talk about the politics of official apologies. How important are these apologies and what impact might they make? But first, Worse Than War, we'll explore eliminationism and genocide in the 20th and 21st century. While the 20th century has been called the mass murder century by scholars, our next guest says hundreds of millions of people are still at risk of becoming victims of genocide and other mass killings. Why do mass killings continue, and how can the cycle be brought to an end? That is the subject of a book called Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. The author, Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, joins us now. Welcome, Daniel Jonah Goldhagen.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, I think I'd like to start with the spectrum that you look at, eliminationism, you call it. You have genocide on one end, but you incorporate all kinds of levels of really mass killings in various ways and also just trying to move populations out. Why don't you talk about this spectrum?
Well, when people typically talk about genocide, they sequester it off from everything else we know about politics and social action. These are treated as volcanic eruptions, uncontrollable ethnic conflicts that bend further out of control. And in fact, the underlying phenomenon is much more familiar. And because it's more familiar, in fact, when you understand it, we can actually do much more about it. And genocide is but the expression of a certain kind of politics, which can be called eliminationism, which is what it sounds like, which is when leaders decide that they want to eliminate groups of people whom they see as a threat or they see as being an impediment to their political goals, whatever they are. And when they decide upon eliminationist policy, they use a variety of policy tools, of implements, in order to eliminate them. They force them to transform themselves, such as force them to convert to another religion. They systematically deny them the right, the ability to reproduce themselves, and this is done through mass rape and other means. They incarcerate them in concentration camps. They expel them. And they kill them, and the largest such killings we call genocide. And so one of the things I argue in the book, Worse Than War, is that we need to recognize this politics and fight all kinds of eliminationism, and it's particularly the case that genocide should be seen as a form of eliminationism when one realizes that in every instance of what we call genocide, the perpetrators have been doing some of these other things that I've mentioned, expelling victims, incarcerating them, preventing the reproduction, and so on. And so this is the underlying phenomenon. It's not been recognized as such, and it's not treated as such. It's not treated as what it is in the international political community and international security discussions. And so one of the things I want to do is to try to shift the discussion and bring this horrible and very widespread form of politics into focus.
Now, you looked over history, and you said the phenomenon is really quite ancient. How far back does it go?
It goes as far back as we know. In the ancient world, slaughtering groups which one conquered was a very normal thing. Slaughtering the men, many of them, all of them, enslaving the others. Slavery, when used, is a form of eliminationism as well. And it's been with us through human history. In the book and the film, I focus on the genocides and eliminations during our time because there's some particular characteristics of what has happened in our world. And most of all, I'm interested in the end in policy, that is, in trying to put an end to the killing.
So let's start then with the 20th century, because, of course, this week is the 8th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, and that is what a lot of scholars called the first genocide of the 20th century. Perhaps you can start with that and put it into this context of your book.
But it's actually not the first genocide of the 20th century. There was a holdover genocide from the 19th century by the Belgians in the Congo, and nobody knows actually how many millions of people they killed there. And the Germans in Southwest Africa in 1904 set out to exterminate the entire Herero people and killed three-quarters of them. And so the Armenian genocide is, of course, deserving of our attention and was horrific beyond horrific, but it is not the first. In 1915, the Turkish government decided to solve its so-called Armenian problem, which they understood to be a threat to the integrity of Turkey because the Armenians were not very eager to be part of Turkey. And so they set out under the cover of war to rid the country of Armenians by killing a huge number, expelling others, and they ended up killing approximately 1.5 million Armenians. As in all other genocides, the killing was not done in a clinical way. It was done utterly brutally. They often tortured their victims. And as in all other genocides, or the perpetrators believed that what they were doing was right. They believed the Armenians, who were Christian, not Muslim, as most Turks were, who were ethnically different, who were an alien people as they understood them, needed to be destroyed or eradicated or eliminated in order for Turkey to prosper. And so you find in genocide after genocide, the Turks of the Armenians, the Holocaust, Guatemala, Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, Darfur today, that the perpetrators are eager, willing, they do much more to their victims than they have to. In other words, they perpetrate cruelties upon them, which are totally unnecessary, even for the act of killing. We need to recognize this and recognize that these are not abstractions that are doing this. These are human beings who are making decisions to raise their hand and strike their victims down.
I thought it was really compelling, one of the breakdowns that you did, looking specifically at the Rwandan genocide. A Tutsi survivor had said to you that 20% killed reluctantly, 40% enthusiastically, 10% helped, and 30% were forced to kill. Now, do you think that's accurate?
We don't know what the exact percentages are, but it captures the sense of what happened in Rwanda. And we should remember that when we're talking about killing in Rwanda, as in some other genocides or mass eliminations, we're talking about neighbors killing neighbors. And we should always keep in mind also they're not killing military-aged men as they would in a military conflict. They're killing them, of course, but they're also killing women, and they're slaughtering children, often in the cruelest of ways. And we have much testimony from perpetrators and victims alike about the enthusiasm of the killers, about their cruelty, about their zeal. And, in fact, in the book and in the film, I've interviewed perpetrators. It is just absolutely stunning to hear them talk about how they view the victims, what they did. And one of the perpetrators in Rwanda says quite clearly that his fellow killers, like himself, and they were killing people living in their commune, his fellow killers and himself, and he says, I include myself among them, did not believe that the Tutsi, that is the people they were killing, were human beings. And he said, if we had believed it, we wouldn't have done it.
One of the things that I think is potentially unique in some of these situations, and Rwanda is one of them, is that the Rwandans, the Hutus and the Tutsis, had lived together for a very long time and really didn't distinguish between each other until the Belgians had come and occupied it and started to separate them out and distinguish them. But even after that, same religion, same language, essentially same people, and there wasn't that much animosity until the radio, RTLM, started broadcasting these messages. How big of a role does the propaganda and the media play in your estimation?
Well, it varies from mass elimination to mass elimination. I would give, and I do give, a slightly different history of Rwanda than you have put forward. It is true the Belgians fomented enmity between the two peoples as a divide-and-conquer strategy for their colonial rule. But it's not as if once the Belgians left in 1960 that this came to an end. There's an enormous amount of testimony that discrimination continued against the Tutsi in Rwanda, that in Hutu circles all kinds of prejudices were common and, in fact, were mother's milk, and they took the notion that Tutsis are snakes, as they called them, or cockroaches, devils in human form, as being just the way the world was. Now, they didn't kill them, and though there were many, you know, there were several mass killings before the great slaughter in which Hutu killed 800,000 Tutsi in 1994. The way we should look at it instead is that in many societies, including Rwanda, long-standing prejudice and hatreds which simmer beneath the surface because the political authorities don't allow them to be expressed in violence can easily be turned on. When they said it's time to kill, the Hutu understood immediately what they were talking about, why they would do it, and they went out and slaughtered their neighbors. And, of course, the messages they were getting that they were being threatened by the Tutsi over the radio that you mentioned and in other ways inflamed them and urged them onward. But if they hadn't believed what they already believed about Tutsi, they would have never done it, as Elie Nigarambe, the perpetrator I mentioned, testify what he said. If they had been, we thought they were human beings, we wouldn't have done it.
Now, do you think that that is also the case in, say, the Armenian genocide and other ones?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the case in most. The great exception to that are the communist mass slaughters, where regimes come into power and have to inculcate a new set of views into the young of the country. But in most mass slaughters, that is not the case, that prejudices that exist in society are quickly activated when political leaders make the decision. But this is the critical point for policy, that genocides don't happen, mass eliminations don't happen just because there's great prejudice. You need the prejudice because you need a group of willing perpetrators, but you need the political leadership to enact a program of systematic mass killing or elimination. If that doesn't happen, you don't have a genocide. And in instance after instance, the decision to initiate the mass killing and elimination has been made by one man or a small group of men and at a discrete time, and they did so because they thought they would get away with it and it would bring them much more benefit than cost. Once you recognize this, you realize that we can change that decision-making moment. We can change their decision-making calculus, make it clear to them the cost of slaughtering and eliminating people will be far greater than the benefits brought to them. And in doing so, we can stay the hand of future would-be genocidal and eliminationist leaders. The state is critical. And this is very different from how people talk about genocide, which is like some kind of volcanic eruption. It's not. It's politics. It's eliminationist politics. It's planned. Start looking at it that way and responding to politics with the tools that we know that work, which is other kinds of politics.
For example?
For example, we have to, first of all, create an international system that is not permissive, which it is now. The international system says that as long as you don't attack people in another country, legally, there's not much anybody can do if you slaughter people in your own country or expel them or put them in camps. The UN and the notion of sovereignty protects states acting within their own borders. We need to change that. We need to stop protecting the dictatorships of the world, which are the proto-genocidal states of the world. In the world today, dictatorships are all potential genocidal states because the violence they use to maintain their power, that is the dictators, the authoritarian rulers, and those who support them, the violence that they use on a regular basis to maintain their power is never that far from being raised to eliminationist levels. If the challenge becomes to their rule becomes that much greater, or if the leaders decide it's finally time to preemptively get rid of that challenge. And so we have to delegitimize these states, stop supporting them, and give them all kinds of incentives, the elites of these countries, to install democratic institutions.
Let me just interrupt you for a moment because, you know, one of the interesting things is that the United States, and you even open your book with the United States and Harry Truman and his mm-hmm. mass killing of Japanese civilians by dropping bombs, and how that, you know, so many people made excuses for it. And then you also talk about the killings in Central America, which were largely funded by the United States. United States is a democratic republic, mm-hmm. and it's not a dictatorship. And it has perpetrated huge numbers of mass killings.
The United States has not bathed itself in glory. We can put it in a much more word. The United States has itself, as you pointed out, it has perpetrated mass slaughters in the past. We can start with Native Americans and move forward. A lot of that was done in the context of the Cold War, when the East-West conflict trumped all moral and considerations. And I think that the United States and other Western countries have learned a great deal, particularly in the last 10 years, about what is right and appropriate and acceptable conduct in international affairs.
I'm really struggling with this only because I'm thinking about the Bush administration and going into Iraq.
Yeah, but what everyone thinks of the war in Iraq, it's not an eliminationist or genocidal undertaking.
But it's still a mess.
We need to make distinctions between war and the out-and-out slaughter of unarmed men, women, and children, which is what takes place during genocide.
The end result of the war in Iraq did end up with massive killings, whether it was eliminationist or not. So the only thing I'm questioning now is your...
Okay. But you see, here's the issue. The international realm is an anarchic realm. So you need to have agents to act well as opposed to acting badly. If you have other agents that you think would be better to stop slaughters in Rwanda, I'm happy to hear who they are. I mean, we have to deal with reality. You know, the problem with tempering the bloodlust is that we have very little ability to affect internally in the different countries what goes on. You need to stop the leadership of the would-be genocidal leaders with negative incentives and positive incentives. I mean, you want to try to do this as peacefully as possible. I'm happy to support any agents, international agents, but one has to who might do this. But the reality is that, as in Bosnia, it was NATO that had the capacity to do it and that actually did it, and it took the use of force. And the question people have to ask themselves, who might look askance at the United States or other Western countries using force, is do they think that the Western forces, the UN, the Belgian forces under the auspices of the UN, should have pulled out in April 1994 in Rwanda and let the people be slaughtered, which is what actually happened? Or should we have inserted more troops there, which we could have, and saved the people? Survivors of genocide say all the time when you go to talk to them, why didn't your country do anything to save us?
Right. And it does beg the question about when to intervene and when not to. And yet, at the same time, I guess the only concern that I have about the argument, when should the U.S. intervene, well, when shouldn't it intervene? But at the same time, of course, under the auspices of what you said, battling the Red War, the U.S. set up dictatorships throughout Latin America, Chile being the perfect example.
Well, I don't want to pretend that democratic countries are angels internationally. Far from it. They have all kinds of self-interest, which don't serve developing countries very well at all. But with regard to killing people, neither the people nor the governments of the advanced industrial democracies, the democratic ones, have any desire to see people being slaughtered elsewhere in the world. And so, yes, I agree with the historical account in my book itself, but I think times have changed, and let's hope that I'm right about this.
Let's hope.
And with regard to intervention, the thing to do is we have to create a prevention system. You don't want to intervene, because once the killing begins, it's too late. Perpetrators can kill 10,000 people in a day, and we have to realize it's 10,000 people, their children being slaughtered, and lives ruined, communities destroyed. And so we want a prevention system so that the would-be genocidal leaders will say, it's not even worth going there. I have to deal with my political problems in other ways. And so that's what we have to think about. There's not even a discussion in the international political community within the UN and elsewhere of what a serious prevention system would look like. And if you can prevent one genocide, you will do more to save lives than if we cut the murder rate, in half in Los Angeles in a year, which everybody would say would be a great accomplishment. I would applaud it, but it would be a drop in the bucket compared to the number of lives we would save if we prevent one genocide.
That's a perfect place to end this. Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, I'd like to say thank you very, very much. Very interesting discussion here. And the film and the book are both called Worse Than War, mm-hmm. Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Although governments rarely apologize for crimes committed against humanity or other injustices that they have perpetrated, says our next guest, sometimes they do, such as in the cases of France and Germany for their crimes during World War II. But many others go unacknowledged by the perpetrating countries. Japan, for example, has yet to make an unambiguous apology to its victims. And Turkey has refused to acknowledge the genocide it perpetrated against the Armenians, much less apologize. But our next guest suggests that official apologies are meaningful. They help to change the terms and meanings of national membership. We're joined now by Melissa Nobles. She is a professor of political science at MIT. She's the author of two books. One is called Shades of Citizenship, Race and the Census in Modern Politics, and the new one, Politics of Official Apologies. Welcome to The Insiders, Melissa Nobles.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you with us. So you argue that countries like Japan and others who have not apologized for their crimes against humanity or other perpetrations are really facing some strained relations as a result, but that countries rarely do these things. So how do we reconcile this?
Right. Well, In the cases of Japan and others, it's generally two types of apologies. One are those international apologies, so Japan for the crimes committed during World War II, and then others to their own citizenry. And typically, international apologies come about largely for geopolitical reasons, which is you apologize because you want to get along better in the world system, and it's frowned upon if you've committed. There's an expectation, at least among certain other countries, that you should apologize. So, in other words, diplomatic pressure can be brought to bear. Even though Japan has apologized unambiguously, it has made several attempts, at least beginning since the 1990s, to apologize for World War II crimes. But as scholars of Japan have documented, there's a tremendous amount of contestation within Japan among right-wing nationalists and others who don't think that Japan should apologize. So typically apologies raise all kinds of issues within domestic politics because there are going to be people who think that apology is undeserved and others who think that it is deserved. And the conflict is over how we interpret history and its moral obligation.
Now, you listed some 72 apologies.
Correct.
Half of these were related to World War II.
Correct.
So since then, or even before then, there have not been very many acknowledgments about the atrocities that have been perpetrated by governments.
That's true. And we might think about it as, in certain ways, apologies, at least in the 20th century, and the latter half of the 20th century, is representing the rise of an international human rights regime. That is a growing understanding that human rights matter, people pressing for apologies and such. Prior to that, while we know that there's been all kinds of atrocities throughout human history, if there hasn't been any pressure brought to bear on governments to apologize, it was typically seen as the unhappy results of history, no matter how horrible the atrocities, right? That's just the way history goes. But in the 20th century, we've seen a different view about that, in that maybe there should be some moral reckoning brought to bear, and perhaps it could be brought by either the direct victims in certain cases or their descendants in others.
Now, you argue that these are actually more meaningful than other symbolic gestures, that actual apologies hold more weight.
Yes, I do. And it's kind of counterintuitive in a way, and I know a lot of people say, oh, what's an apology? It's just empty talk and such. But typically what an apology can do is that it sets the terms for discussion about what next. So in other words, if you're willing to, a big part of not wanting to think about the past is because it's just a flat denial of it, right? We don't want to acknowledge, as I imagine we talked about earlier about Turkey not wanting to acknowledge the Armenian genocide, in part because when you acknowledge something, then questions follow, which is, well, now that you've acknowledged it, what are you going to do to rectify it? So in that way, an apology sets the terms for another discussion about what is to come next. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a discussion about reparations, for example. When people think about if America apologizes for slavery, to just use one example, well, that means that we're going to have to pay reparations. Not necessarily, but it will mean that we can have a discussion about what else might we do to think about rectifying slavery's legacy, such as Jim Crow's legacy. So it gives citizens a way of anchoring their concerns about the present with the legacy of the past and making history an important part of that discussion.
Now, you mentioned the Turkish government, and today, since it is the commemoration of the Armenian Genocide, we have done a considerable amount on this issue. And you actually open your book calling the denial or lack of apology from the Turkish government to be the most notorious. Why did you call it the most notorious?
Yeah, I don't know that was hyperbolic, but it's certainly, at least in the late 20th century now, it's getting a lot of attention. It continues to be one that people are focusing on, in part because of Turkey's insistence not to apologize. And as you well know, there's robust debate among historians about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of Turkey and what happened to Armenians. But the adjective notorious, I think, is partly because of the ways in which the issue seems so polarized. And with the exception of a growing number of Turkish historians within Turkey proper, who apparently are not well received, at least by the Turkish government, will lead one to suggest that there's not that the revisiting of this issue is going to take a bit longer, and that Armenians will continue to have to press for an apology, and hopefully garner some support from other groups around the world.
Now, in some cases, there have been some cases where the apology has been very meaningful.
Yes.
I think the one that you mentioned was Germany having to apologize for the Holocaust and has, to the tune of about $100 billion, mm-hmm. made payments to survivors, to Israel, to other victims.
Yes.
But that's really rare. So yes. even if somebody, some country like Turkey, like Japan, like Australia, you mentioned Australia for its treatment of its indigenous people, it's rare that that actually comes to fruition.
Yes, it is. In the end, I mean, if you think about the, in the grand scheme of things, it is rare that governments do it. Most of the cases that I've talked about, of the ones that you're mentioning, with the exception of Germany, the rare cases are those where a government apologizes to its own citizenry. It's more common for there to be apologies between governments, and as I said earlier, that largely has to do with the dynamics of international politics. But when you think about a government having to apologize to its own citizenry, it is quite rare, and it comes about mostly, there has to be two people who want this to happen, two groups of actors, the aggrieved group themselves and political elites. And if the political elite are not interested in it, that is, they're not willing to push it, they're not willing to be responsive to demands that are being made towards them, then there won't be an apology. So that you have to get political elites interested, and the question is, how do you do that? How is it in their political interest? And that is the stuff of politics.
So how important is it, do you think, for aggrieved victims to pursue these kinds of apologies?
Right. Well, I think it's important. It's not the only tactic that one could have. And I know there's a big, you know, there's oftentimes discussions whether if a group has, organized groups have lots of ways in which they can expend their energies, both monetary energies as well as their physical energies. And where do you spend your political capital? And should we spend it at telling a government apologize for the past? Well, typically the only time that's used is for at least in the cases of indigenous people where it's been successful in Canada and now Australia, is that that many claims for the present, that is land claims, getting the government to recognize the harm that was done over centuries, rests finally in an open acknowledgement of history, not a piecemeal, not, you know, something off the side, but a public discussion of history. And apologies are one of the most direct and effective ways of getting a discussion about history going, right? One that simply says, let's look at the historical record, let's look at the full historical record, and let's make a moral judgment about it, right? Let's finally say that wasn't a good thing and it's had deleterious consequences. And for groups who think that history is really important in anchoring their current day claims are going to look for apologies. If one thinks that we just ought to demand better treatment simply because we're citizens, and it has nothing to do with our past, I mean, we know what happened to us, but we're not going to make that the focus of our political strategy. Instead, we're going to say we demand change because we are citizens and we're starting from right now. Then you would think that apologies aren't important to your strategy. So in the end, for an aggrieved group, there has to be some kind of discussion about where history fits and thinking about a strategy moving forward.
Melissa Nobles, this is quite profound. I really want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa Nobles is a professor at MIT. She's the author of The Politics of Official Apologies. How many boys were in that pile, do you know?
Well, I would say there was about 8 or 10. And here's, you see this?
Scar right here on your face?
Yeah, they got me right there.
With a sword?
With a sword or bayonet. And I was in a pile of kids, you know. I couldn't cry. If I did, I wouldn't be here today.
It's because they thought you were dead.
They thought I was dead, yeah. So in the evening, the mothers and grandmothers, aunts, they went and picked up their kid that weren't dead yet. And those that were dead, they pushed into the river, Euphrates River, to go down. Others over there, with their hands, dug a grave in the sand on the shore and buried them.
That was the voice of Sam Kadorian, who escaped the genocide as a little boy. You are listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. The Young Turks decided to eliminate an entire ethnic group that lived alongside them within the Ottoman Empire. The Armenian Genocide, in which some 1.5 million Armenians were systematically killed, is considered the first of the 20th century by many scholars. Ostensibly, the Armenian Genocide informed Adolf Hitler's quest to eliminate the Jews decades later. And despite calls to never again let such atrocities occur, governments have continued to annihilate their own people, including the 1994 Rwandan Genocide, in which some 800,000 Tutsi people were systematically and brutally killed in only 100 days. Why do genocides happen? What are the conditions for genocide? And how can they be prevented in the future? We have with us Alex Hinton. He is executive director at the Center for Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is a professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and the first vice president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars. He's authored numerous books, including the award-winning Why Did They Kill? Cambodia and the Shadow Genocide. And he has six other edited or co-edited collections. Professor Vahakan Dadrian is director of genocide research at the Zorian Institute. He's been a professor of sociology at the State University of New York and was director of the genocide study project sponsored by the H.F. Guggenheim Foundation, which published the history of the Armenian Genocide, Ethnic Conflict from the Balkans to Anatolia and the Caucasus. He's also authored German Responsibility in the Armenian Genocide, Warrant for Genocide, and Key Elements of the Turkish Denial of the Armenian Genocide. We also have with us Dr. Richard Hrayar Dekmedjan. He's a professor of political science at University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He's also the founder and director of USC's Institute of Armenian Studies. He's written numerous books that includes the latest Spectrum of Terror, as well as earlier books such as The Patterns of World Leadership. His specialties include world leadership, terrorism, and genocide. So welcome to all three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. Given the date and the anniversary that is upon us of the Armenian Genocide, I'd like to start with that particular occurrence in history. Vahakan Dadrian, let's have you begin with what happened in 1915 and why it still matters today.
I think the most significant feature of the Armenian Genocide is that it was World War I period, the context for atrocities all over the world on a global scale, and the Ottoman perpetrators took advantage of the opportunity afforded by this global war. Secondly, the men folk in the category of 20 to 45 years old, all men, Armenian men folk, were conscripted by the Ottoman army, thereby creating a huge mass of Armenian women and children in utmost vulnerability to victimization. To understand the Armenian genocide, and this brings into a relationship with the Jewish Holocaust, that both genocides were perpetrated by the opportunities afforded by a global war.
Richard Dekmedjan.
I've been laboring with a book of mine about the leadership factor in five genocides, and specifically in the Armenian and the Holocaust cases. I look at the war itself and the previous period of crisis in these societies, both the Ottoman and the Ottoman Turkish and the German. And during those crises, you have what I call marginal men, men from the margins of that society, coming in and gaining supreme power, and then targeting a community, a particular community, Armenians and Jews respectively, and exterminating them as some kind of a ideological imperative, because these people tried to be the super Turk and the super Germans, in a sense, to justify their claim to power. Therefore, these minorities were victimized as a result of that.
When you say ideological imperative, you mean that these particular ethnic groups were in the way of some ideology?
These ethnic groups were in the way of a grand design, as Professor Dadyan, of course, illustrates so many times in his works. In the case of the Turkish case, you had the pan-Turanist imperative, the dream of establishing a Turan, pan-Turkish empire from Constantinople, from the Balkans all the way to Central Asia, and that the Armenians and other Christians, but particularly Armenians, geostrategically, were in the way. It corresponds to the German notion, the Nazi notion of Lebensraum, whereby there were Jews particularly, but as well as other communities, Poles, Ukrainians, Gypsies, and homosexuals, and so on, were targeted as undesirable people for not only in terms of eugenics, but also in terms of their existence in Central Europe, where the German race needed Lebensraum, living space, and therefore they have to be destroyed.
Alex Hinton.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to thank my colleagues for their remarks. I might take a slightly different tack. In terms of the meaning and the importance of the commemoration, I think that the theme of denial has to be set in the forefront. The case of the Armenian genocide being denied by the Turkish government is something that effectively flags for everybody else. It's okay to perpetrate a genocide. You can just try and deny it afterwards. And in another sense, denial is linked during the actual process of the genocide to the genocidal process. So in a sense, the denial continues the genocide. And in fact, if you think about it, you have the first death of the victims, which takes place during the genocide itself. The second death is a symbolic social one that takes place through a campaign of denial. So on the day that the Turkish government and the international community recognizes the Armenian genocide clearly, that will be an important moment and a statement to everybody that it's not appropriate to deny genocide, you can't do it, and that will not be tolerated.
Let's bring Vahakan Dadrian back in. Now, the Turkish government says that what was actually occurring was a civil war, and their remarks are generally that Armenians were also killing Turks. What actually did happen?
In order to understand the persistence of Turkish denial, we have to understand the conditions that afforded such a denial. Therefore, I like to come to a major issue characterizes the Armenian genocide. In fact, it distinguishes itself in terms of most other genocides of the 20th century, and that is the impunity afforded the Turkish perpetrators. Prior to the Armenian genocide of World War I, in the 1890s, particularly 1894 and 1896, the Ottoman government perpetrated massive scale of massacres in the Armenian provinces. Approximately 200,000 Armenians were massacred in broad daylight in a period of 3 consecutive days. There was no punishment, no trial, no condemnation from either inside or outside Turkey. There were protests, but that was it. And I believe that this impunity of 19th century massacres was a major contributing factor in the decision-making of the genocide of World War I. When impunity is afforded to the perpetrators, certain psychological developments take place in the frame of mind of the perpetrators. Number one, they begin to take the atrocities for granted. It facilitates denial of the crime, and as a result of it, the perpetrators and their heirs become defiant historically and otherwise, and as a result, a zeal develops to repeat the crime when opportunities present themselves, and there's still another conflict with the victim group. The problem of impunity is a major factor in the analysis of genocide in general, because one of its general byproducts, apart from the particular victim and the particular perpetrator, that it tends to become contagious for other future perpetrators. I believe that if the Armenian genocide was criminally prosecuted and entailing massive punishment and retributive justice, I would hesitate to say that the Nazis would be emboldened to proceed to the campaign of Jewish Holocaust. And I think this is best illustrated by the statement attributed to Adolf Hitler, who in 1939 reportedly, to assuage the concern of some German generals who were being advised that the Polish nation has to be destroyed, they said, "Don't worry, who remembers the Armenian genocide?"
This is the Adolf Hitler quote. After all, who remembers the Armenians that justified that he could continue on his killing rampage? So what you're saying is that it's quite possible that the Armenian genocide, through its lack of prosecution, was giving birth to the future genocides. And that is one of the significant elements and one of the reasons why recognition and acknowledgement of these things and prosecution is so important. Richard Dickmedjian, you've looked at a broad swath of genocides and looked at these analytically. What are the conditions?
A society in crisis, usually in the case of the first two, certainly, where the world is, you know, involved in two major wars. But the crisis environment is very important in any case, because the crisis environment gives rise to a certain kind of génocidaire, they use the French word, certain pathologically inclined people who come from margins of society and grab power and use it brutally. And then there are other factors such as the ideological imperative. These people have a program to implement, which they justify ideologically to their followers. Then, of course, they, beyond the grabbing power, they have to have a mechanism, like the Teşkilat-ı Mahsuse in the case of the special organism in the case of the Turks, and the Schutzstaffel and the other organizations in the case of Nazis, and you see them in every one of these recent genocides as well, an elite that specializes in killing, mass killing, programming, and all of those factors. And last but not least, lack of external intervention. As the professor pointed out, the Turks got away with it, and many of the so-called young Turks, the jihadists, lived to prosper, and some of them took leading positions in the Kemalist regime, in the so-called secular Turkish Republic under Atatürk. So when people get away with that kind of mass killing, it happens again. That's why the International Court is so important. And that's why it's important to recognize these genocides.
I'd like to continue on this path for just a second about these conditions for genocide. And I guess we should also use the word politicide, which brings Professor Hinton back in. You interviewed the perpetrators as well.
Yeah, you know, I also think it's important to point out that I don't find the term politicide particularly useful. The you know, it derives from the UN Genocide Convention, which came out and protected four groups at the expense of many others. And again, it was mainly through political bargaining and the entrance of the different delegates at the UN who were debating this. So effectively, you know, I and many other scholars view genocide as an attempt to destroy in whole or in part another group of human beings. And so I tend not to use terms like politicide. It's a genocide. So having said that, in terms of this question of both the preconditions for genocide and the process of perpetrator motivation, which are both things I explore in my book, Why Do They Kill?, I would just add to the comments that Professor Dickmedjian said that there's also, you know, the question is, why do people follow leaders who espouse a message of hate? It's not a straightforward process. It's a difficult thing to do. In all of these different situations, the leaders have to come up with an ideology that fits and meshes with local understandings that are meaningful to people. In the case, if we want to switch over, for example, to Cambodia, you know, the Khmer Rouge had to play upon Buddhism, which it had already banned, but to use Buddhist idioms because they were resonant with the peasants, many of whom had gone into the pagoda for many years. So it's actually, you know, it's a difficult thing to motivate people to do these things. And I think it's important not to simply say, well, a perpetrator, a regime comes in and they simply order people to go kill. People are ready and willing to do so, and it proceeds in a straightforward manner. There are different sectors of society, and there are different echelons of people. People vary in their motivations, and it's very important in terms of thinking, for example, of combating genocide, to be aware of these different domains in which, if, for example, if dehumanization or certain rituals of degradation are operative to combat, we have to know and understand what's going on these local levels, and it's absolutely critical also in the long term to think about this. Again, we have a thing where we think of genocide beginning and ending. genocides continue into the future. I would argue that the Armenian genocide continues into the present. I would argue that the genocide against Native Americans, which is also denied and unrecognized, continues into the present. It becomes something that's structural. It links to cultural genocide, and the denial is one more phase in that. So again, you know, in some ways, I think scholars need to rework their understandings of these different things. And I should also note that, for example, we had a conference here last month on forgotten genocides, and the sort of part of the theme of it was to think about how structures of power and knowledge also shape not just public perception, but also the perception of scholars. And I should say, first of all scholars, the vast majority of scholars acknowledge the Armenian Genocide, and that should be known. It's been acknowledged by the International Association of Genocide Scholars. But the way we look at events, we look at some events and we talk about them and we forget about others. And this conference explored that. Native Americans were one group that's been largely forgotten. The Ukrainian Genocide, the Circassian Genocide, there are many other examples in history. And so I think all of us, again, in terms of combating denial and forgetting, need to rework the way we think about these things. I think it's absolutely critical, along with actively combating denial, such as that espoused by the Turkish government.
You named several genocides that have been forgotten, and the Armenian one probably would be forgotten if it not for some scholars such as yourself and the Armenian community itself. What are the politics behind forgetting or non-recognition?
Forgetting, in a sense, is linked to denial. If you see also the notion that once something's forgotten, no one talks about it. So effectively, it has the same effect as being denied. There are very specific political reasons for denying, horrible things have happened in the past. First of all, you may be criminally liable, especially after the passage of the UN Genocide Convention, right? It also, in terms of the international community, if in fact something's labeled and recognized as genocide, it implies both a moral and a legal imperative that they need to do something about it, which is why nobody ever wants to actively use the word. And we've seen, before Darfur, all attempts to dissemble and not actually use the word genocide to talk about these events in the past. If you go, just on a sort of pragmatic basis, nobody wants to say that basically, the origins of their government and their country are bound up with acts of genocide. For example, as I sit here in my office in the United States, it's a place where Native Americans used to live. They've been eradicated. They've been confined. They've been taken to reservations. They've been losing their language. Their high incidences, again, in terms of structural factors that disempower them and, again, leads to the fragmentation of these communities. The United States, right, exists in a situation of genocide that effectively is denied and forgotten. In the same way, in Turkey, who wants to remember that the origins of the modern Turkish state is bound up completely with genocide? Again, it's inconvenient and it muddies the sort of pure historical genealogy that all countries like to have. If your origin begins with genocide, it means that you have to actually confront something like this, and it doesn't make for good education in the schools, and that's among many other things. And I think, talking about education perhaps is something we need to talk about, because also in terms of different governments, when they teach about genocide in the United States, we used to celebrate Columbus Day. It still is celebrated. Right, but if you think about it, Christopher Columbus came in and was responsible directly or indirectly for the deaths of millions of Taino Indians. People don't want to talk about it, and education is one of the most important steps to rectifying denial and forgetting. And it's once if people engage and think about this, the hope is that in the future, when genocide is about to take place, people won't stand for it and they'll speak out.
Richard Dick Midgen.
The genocidal birth of modern Turkey is rarely, rarely mentioned. I read in The Nation a review of a book on the whole period from the Ottoman to the present period, and neither the author nor the book reviewer ever talked about the Armenians and all of the other minorities which were subject to genocide. There's new research now showing that various other Christian communities, Assyrians, Syriacs, Chaldeans, and others, and Greeks, Pontic Greeks, and other Greeks, were subject to genocide as well during 1915, before and after 1915 as well, way before what happened at Smyrna, that whole massacre under Mustafa Kemal himself. In fact, he was in town at that time. In addition to the Arabs, not only Christian Arabs, but Muslim Arabs, and Kurds. Of course, the Kurds were instrumental in killing Armenians as a part of Abdülhamid's Hamidiye units, but then also used by the Young Turks. But the Young Turks killed a lot of Kurds as well, maybe about 250,000. So that kind of genocidal, that kind of violent birth of the modern Turkish Republic, precisely because Turkey's geostrategic position and incredibly active diplomacy and massive amounts of money that Turkey, you know, spends on it, genocide denial is a global business. And so many governments, including our own, and people who work in the government and may leave the government, become a part of this genocide denial process, starting with the Dulles brothers, by the way. The Dulles brothers, later on Secretary of State, but Dulles and his brother, Alan, the former head of CIA.
Turkey now, why is it so invested in the denial? Is it fear of reparations? Nobody's going to get prosecuted at this point. Nobody's alive anymore. Bahakan Dadrian.
First of all, before we explain that, I would like to add that in contradistinction to the Jewish Holocaust, there was massive popular participation in the Armenian Genocide, particularly the provincial peasant population actively engaged in massacres against local Armenian populations. And to understand this, we have to focus on a particular feature of the Armenian Genocide, namely the role of Islam. Islamic doctrines were energized. Of course, we know that, like the Nazi leaders, the Young Turk leaders, most of them were agnostics. They didn't believe in religion. But they went out of their way to sensitize, agitate, and incite the Muslim masses in the provinces against the Armenians. And here enters another factor into the picture, namely the possession, coming into possession of the accumulated wealth of the victim population. Peasants, ordinary peasants, became overnight ultra-rich people. There was a massive transfer of wealth from the victim to the perpetrator population. Now, to come to the problem of denial, why did the Turks persist in denial? I think there are three major reasons that need focal attention. One of them is that they have denied for almost 9 decades, and if the denial is overlooked and all of a sudden they accept the crime, they will look very foolish. Why? Why for 9 decades? In other words, it will compromise the integrity of successive generations of Turkish governments and leaderships in committing this denial. Secondly, when you deny, then when you agree or accept the validity of the crime, there is the very serious, critical issue of compensation. I think, in my judgment, one of the key reasons why the Turkish authorities persist in denying the crime is to avoid any possibility of compensating the Armenians. And the third one is, of course, if you acknowledge the crime, you have to engage in a massive revamping of the Turkish educational system. The entire history books have to be rewritten, and all the authors who have written books, Turkish historians, they will look foolish. In other words, the consequences for the authorities, for the government, for the people, for the Turkish nation is very grim.
If we want to talk about prevention, are there steps both with regular people and governments and institutions and non-governmental organizations that can be taken to make this actually never occur again? Richard Dikmejian.
There are some positive signs, but very little. Increasingly, very liberal and brave Turkish scholars have started using the genocide term to describe what happened to the Armenians at the risk of either getting killed in Turkey if they go back, or being thrown into jail under Article 301, which is the infamous article. Now, of course, this is a small minority of very brave souls, mostly, by the way, living outside Turkey, Turkish scholars and Orhan Pamuk and other famous writers. But in case of the Obama administration, yes, it's going to be not well received by Turkey. They can threaten to do all kinds of things, as they tried to do to France. But after 6 months, they forget about it, because Turkey needs the United States much more than the United States needs Turkey. This is what we don't seem to understand in this country. I'll stop.
Prevention. Professor Hinton.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Just to link it back, again, I just want to make the point that one means of preventing genocide is to combat denial, because denial effectively perpetuates a genocide. So it's symbolic, but in fact it has very important repercussions to show other regimes that you can't do this. Recently, the sort of post-Rwanda, post-Bosnia, and now Darfur, there have been movements to develop different infrastructures, legal infrastructures, regional alignments. The concept of, for it's somewhat controversial, responsibility to protect is supposed to feed into us. But I think it's important, whatever the critiques are of some of these new infrastructures that have been built, to note that they didn't exist before. So we actually have new tools that have emerged that potentially can help, at least to some degree, in the prevention of genocide. But, I think the importance of education cannot be underestimated, that there's a problem of awareness. You say, I sometimes, again, as a group of students, I say, what is genocide? Very few people have heard of the term. If you mention Pol Pot, many students have no idea who Pol Pot is. And if you mention other leaders who've been linked to genocide, education and awareness is absolutely critical because it enables citizens to speak out. But we shouldn't just think about, the countries like our own in the United States. But also it's important in countries where genocide's taken place, because one of the greatest predictors of genocide is past genocide and mass violence. So I think in general, there needs to be an engagement, an attempt to spread understanding and have dialogue be promoted, even as we develop these infrastructures.
Vaha Kandadrian, that gives you the last word.
Okay. In my judgment, prevention is intimately connected with punishment. History and record of punishment, and unfortunately, the record of punishment in relation to genocide is dismal in human history. And I think the Nuremberg is an exception. And even then, I believe that if the victims were only the Jews, I doubt whether we would have a Nuremberg trial. The problem that, as far as history is concerned, recent history, there has been no successful prosecution, significant prosecution of genocide. All perpetrators of post-World War II genocides have more or less escaped significant punishment.
Let me thank all three of you for joining us. Alex Hinton, Executive Director at the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. Professor Vaha Kandadrian, Director of Genocide Research at the Zorian Institute. And Dr. Richard Harayer Dekmejian, Professor of Political Science at University of Southern California and Founder and Director of USC's Institute of Armenian Studies. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sad Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.